If you're a fan of boxing, you may very well have heard of my next guest. He's got a pretty unforgettable name. It's Lovemore Ndaw. Lovemore is a three-time world champion boxer and now a practicing lawyer in Australia. And it's a far cry from the world he came from. Lovemore's growing up life was a life of extreme poverty, danger, and entrenched racism, because Lovemore grew up most of the time in South Africa and Zimbabwe as well. And of course, he was there to witness the fall of the apartheid regime all those years ago. By the age of 16, Lovemore had been imprisoned. He'd been falsely accused. He'd been beaten. And he'd also witnessed firsthand murder and torture. His book is called Tough Love, the amazing true story of a boxing world champion turned lawyer. And Lovemore, welcome to Life Matters here on ABC Radio National.
Thank you. Thank you for having me on the program.
Lovemore, you describe where you come from as a kid as the middle of nowhere, a town of drudgery, desperation and dreamers. Tell us a bit more about this place.
I was born in a little town called Musina, which is right at the border between South Africa and Zimbabwe. I come from a very, very poor family, you know, and when I say poor, I mean to an extent that, you know, there were days that I would go to bed without a meal. I didn't start school till I was 9 years of age, and part of it had to do, you know, with being poor, and it also had to do, you know, with the political, you know, situation at the time. So when I started school, I had to find a job. You know, I would finish school and then go work, you know, for other people, you know, cleaning their gardens or, you know, cleaning their houses so I could pay for my school uniform and, you know, my school fees. The town was just full of what we used to call totsies. You know, totsie means gang. Depending on what street you came from, you had to join a certain gang. You had no choice. Those are things that I was exposed to when I was growing up.
And Lovemore, even at the age of 9, were you expected to join a gang?
Oh, yeah, definitely. You know, from the moment you start walking around in the streets, you know, you are expected to join a gang, you know, or otherwise, you know, you'll be a victim.
And what was life like at home, Lovemore?
I come from a very poor family, but a good family. You know, I was raised well. I was raised to respect other people. I was raised to love, you know. But just being exposed to the environment, you know, because of the apartheid system, you know, I was treated, you know, as a subspecies, you know, in my own country of birth. I was angry. You know, I was just an angry young man.
And you said you came from a good family, but the living conditions inside the house were pretty basic at the best.
Well, not basic, poor, you know. We slept on the floor. I mean, we lived in a shack. There were days, you know, where we'll go by without a meal. That's how poor we were.
And as you say, surrounded by violence, surrounded by corruption, and surrounded by people who also were desperately trying to find a better life. You didn't start school till you was 9, I think you said, and now you've got, what, 6 university degrees?
Yes, and working on my 7th.
So for those people, you know, who think perhaps that if you start late in education that you're always going to be struggling, you're a case in point to show otherwise.
Well, the message is just because you had a bad start in life doesn't mean that's the end of it. Life is full of challenges. There's going to be some hurdles you're going to need to overcome in life. But, you know, don't give up on your dream. Keep chasing your dream.
And Lovemore, do you think your mother calling you Lovemore was a benefit in chasing that dream?
I think so. You know, the funny thing is, I don't know what she was thinking when she gave me the name. You know, if she was still alive, I would ask her. In the beginning, I really didn't understand it. But, you know, as I grew up, I started to realize, you know what, maybe there was a message she was trying to send to me or, you know, my family out there that, you know, well, you got to love. You got to love more, irrespective of what's going on.
You describe really accurately from your point of view what occurred and the kind of fear that inspires when a white girl in your neighborhood, who is the daughter of a white shop owner, starts to express an interest in you. You describe how terrified you were by her attention, and that proved to be a valid feeling. Just explain what happened with that situation.
It happened at a time when black and white relations, you know, were not allowed in South Africa. You could pretty much be jailed or killed for that. And, you know, the girl took a liking on me. So the father didn't like that. And, you know, he used his power and, you know, he used the police, you know, to get even with me. Initially, you know, I was accused of sexually assaulting the girl. You know, luckily the girl, you know, told them, look, if you're going to say this, I'm going to tell the whole world that that's not true, you know, that I just like him. So eventually they didn't know what to charge me with, you know, so they decided to just lock me up, incarcerate me for 90 days without a charge. You know, back then they had a law where they could incarcerate, you know, political, you know, activists for up to 90 days without a charge. But the law was getting abused and used on anyone they didn't like.
And you were 16 at the time, weren't you?
I was only 16. After I've done my 90 days and then I got dragged to a court on that day, and apparently I stole something from the shop. And I get charged for stealing candy and then I get sentenced to 6 cuts. And then I got lashed on that day. And they called, you know, referring to me, you know, as a, you know, in Afrikaans they say kafir, which is, you know, kafir, which is, it is a very, very derogatory term.
Yes.
And I mean, they kept referring to me as a kafir, you know, while they were punishing me. And I just lost it and I told them to F off. You know, that was the biggest mistake I made. You know, they started kicking me, you know, they beating me up. You know, they pretty much almost, you know, broke my ribs and, you know, they broke my arm. And then they set a dog on me, you know, almost beat my eye off. You know, often people see the scar on my right eye. You know, people think it's from boxing. No, that's from a dog bite. But you know what? I recall, you know, sitting in the hospital while I was recovering, and I was thinking to myself, you know what? This is not justice. This is not fair. You know, and thinking to myself, you know what? Someday I need to do something about it. And that day I decided that, you know, someday I was going to be a lawyer or a political activist, you know, and fight for justice.
And look what happened.
It happened. Everything happens for a reason in this world. You know, and I think, you know what, in a way I look at it and I say, I don't regret what happened to me. You know, I think it made me the person that I am today. And had it not happened, I probably wouldn't be a lawyer today. And I probably wouldn't never had been a world champion. And I probably wouldn't be speaking to you right now.
Yes, but I mean, what is also included in what's happened to you, Lamore, is you and your determination not to let injustice beat you, whether it be in the boxing ring or whether it be in the court. You've always stood up tall and firm in that regard, and that shines throughout the book. And while we're talking about that pivotal moment in jail where the white police were bashing you and the dog attacked you and there was every chance you could have actually lost your life in that cell. Tell us about another pivotal part of that, along with resolving to follow the justice and legal path as a career at that moment. You also had the intervention from someone who actually directed you towards a boxing career as well.
I'd already started a boxing career then.
Yes, that's right.
I was only an amateur. You know, there was a guy called Peter, Sergeant Peter. You know, he and another guy, you know, they got me into boxing, Davis Hero. They were like our trainers. So when I got arrested, Sergeant Peter was there begging the police, you know, telling them, no, he's a good kid, you know, let him go. You know, he made a mistake.
He was literally on his knees begging for your life.
He was on his knees, yes, and crying. You know, but they didn't listen. You know, they almost killed me despite that. Pretty much, you know, up to this day, I think he saved my life. When they eventually let me go, I remember when I left the police station and I was walking towards the hospital because I had lost so much blood. You know, I was getting a bit dizzy, you know, and, you know, lucky enough, you know, Sergeant Peter showed up and he picked me up in his, you know, in the police van and took me to the hospital. Chances are I probably wouldn't have made it to the hospital if it wasn't, you know, for Sergeant Peter.
Yeah. I love that story about where you started by playing football or soccer, as we know it in Australia, but you kept being sent off because you were just too angry.
I was. Look, I was always into sports because I always thought, you know, sports would be my ticket, you know, out of poverty. Sports would be my ticket out of, you know, racist South Africa. So I tried all kinds of sports, but I was good at soccer. But I didn't last long in the field because each time somebody played rough, I would turn around and knock them out, and then I'll get sent off. I was so angry to your point that, you know, sometimes I'll be chasing other players instead of chasing the ball. You know, and people used to place bets to see, you know, how long I was going to last before I got, you know, red carded. And one day we were playing and then I knocked this kid out cold. And then they got a security guard, you know, to escort me out of the field. And I remember him talking to me, saying to me, kid, you know, soccer is not for you, you know, because you don't last long in the field. I think you should try boxing. So I went to the gym the next day, and that was the beginning of my career. And he said to me, look, we really, really need to work on your anger. And I thought at first, I thought, no, this is fighting. You need to be angry to fight. But no, I was wrong because, you know, boxing, you need to have a clear mind when you fight. You know, anger doesn't help you. For example, you try and fix something or you try and solve a problem when you're angry. You know, you just make more mistakes. So I had to learn the hard way. You know, he put me in sparring and I was so angry and I was getting beat up. Eventually, I told myself, no, I need to start listening. So I started listening to him and, you know, I started staying calm. And I realized every time I was calm and collected, you know, I was doing well. And it changed me as a person. From this angry young kid, I became this calm and collected person that I am today. I'm very grateful to boxing because growing up in South Africa, where, you know, almost every teenager walked around with a gun or a knife, had I not changed my attitude, I'll probably be dead today or locked up in jail.
And there was every reason for you to be angry as a young boy. Because, Lovemore, you went to Zimbabwe briefly for about 3 years, I think, with your family.
Yes.
And while you were there with your much-loved parents and your sisters and the rest of the family, you witnessed what no one of any age should witness when it comes to a bunch of people, in fact, at the hands of Robert Mugabe's gangs who were vying for independent control of the country, what they did to the community you were living in with your uncle at that stage. I don't want to go through it in graphic detail here, but I do want to mention that it involved death and murder and mutilation, which you saw firsthand through the side of a house in front of you. It's no wonder you come back to South Africa and the soccer field with so much anger and hate in your heart, because how does anyone deal with that kind of cataclysm of death in front of them?
I witnessed, you know, a lot of atrocities, you know, committed, you know, against, you know, the community, including my family members. And coming back to South Africa as well, you know, I witnessed more, you know, because there was also black-on-black violence. During that time, you know, if some blacks thought, you know, you're a traitor, they would put a tire on your neck, they would dose it, you know, with petrol, and then, you know, they'll ban you. So I had to witness those things. You know, I was scarred. Actually, I'm scarred for life too, you know. For years, I've struggled, you know, to deal with these traumas. There's been times where, you know, I would wake up at night, you know, with nightmares, you know, but that's something I'm going to have to deal with for the rest of my life.
My guest is Lovemore Nadal. He is a boxing world champ turned lawyer, has been living in Australia for nigh on, is it 3 decades now?
Yeah, it's almost 24, going 25 years now, so yeah.
25 years.
Yes.
Yeah. How did your boxing career get you to Australia to even appreciate that this may be an option for you?
Well, you know, I got an opportunity to come fight in Australia in 1995. And I remember before I came here, I did some researches about Australia. And actually, I remember reading somewhere where they say Australia used to have the Keep Australia Wide policy. I was expecting, you know, when I come here, I'll be facing the same things that I was used to in South Africa. So I expected people to, you know, to treat me as a subspecies, you know. But I was shocked when I came to Australia. Here I was, you know, as an outsider fighting a local kid, and people didn't see color in me. People just saw another human being, you know. Mm. And so the reception that I received made me fall in love with the country. And I remember going back to South Africa, and, you know, I was married then, and telling my wife, we're moving to Australia. She didn't believe it. And then, you know, 6 months later, you know, we were back in Australia in 1996, and we've been here since then. And I don't regret making that, you know, move. You know, I'm very, very grateful for the opportunities that this country has provided me. it's given me all the opportunities that my own country of birth wouldn't provide to me. You know, so I love this country.
As a black man, everyone asks you how racist Australia is, and you counter that, and I think it's a really interesting answer. You say that you don't feel like we are racist inherently, but there is certainly racist profiling that goes on. Tell us about the story of when you were having a relationship with a Anglo woman, and she and you were walking down the street and were accosted by two white hoons in a car. What happened next?
You know, at the time I was dating Lauren Eagle. You know, we went for a walk, and then these two hooligans, you know, they drove next to us, and then they stopped their car, and then they started, you know, making some racist comments, you know, directed at both of us. But eventually they made a comment. I felt they were insulting my girlfriend. Then I responded, you know, I told them where to go. And then, you know, they came out of the car, they were going to fight me. And then, you know, I didn't run away. But then, you know, Lauren ran into the police station that was just next to where we were. And she tells the police, look, there are two guys out there attacking my boyfriend. Okay, now, about six cops come out running. You know, I'm in the middle of the street, with these two guys facing them up. Now, the police, you know, when they came, guess who they grab? They grab me, you know, and throw me on the ground. They don't grab the two guys. You know, it wasn't up until Lauren said to them, no, you idiot, you know, this is my boyfriend and these are the idiots that are, you know, attacking him.
You're right in the book, even the two guys who were intimidating you were astonished at what happened.
They were astonished. So how did they mistake one black guy with two guys? You know, so to me, that was a case of, you know, racial profiling. You know, but based on that, I wouldn't say Australia, you know, is a racist country. You know, you're always going to have one or two people there, you know, who are always going to act like idiots, you know. And I also talk about another incident, you know, when I became a lawyer.
Yes.
You know, I recall in the beginning, I would walk into a courtroom, you know, I'll go sit at the bench, you know, there'll be other white lawyers sitting next to me. And then a court officer walk up to me and say, are you a lawyer? This is reserved for lawyers. Then I'll be thinking to myself, you know, and I'll say, did you ask my friends here if they are lawyers? No, only because they're white. Some court officers will come to me and say, oh, no, this is for lawyer. You got to sit at the back.
That causes so much psychological harm when people just assume you shouldn't be there because of the colour of your skin. And you debated with yourself about how insulting you could be back. But you actually came up with a really good tactic, Lovemore. Tell people what you say now.
Look, you know, every time that happened, you know, I would be so pissed off and it would take me some days to get over it. You know, but eventually I realized to myself, you know what, I can't do this to myself, you know. I need to come up, you know, with some reverse psychology. You know, I would walk back to the courtroom and if they asked me something like that, you know, are you a lawyer? And I would say, yeah, a damn good one and sexy as F. So they would laugh about it and they would remember me. So, you know, each time I went back, you know, they would just look at me and laugh at me and they remember who I was and treated me with respect. You know, but today, and I can understand back in the day, truth be told, you know, we really didn't have much lawyers from other backgrounds. It was mostly Caucasian who are lawyers in Australia. But now we've got, you know, lawyers from the African background, from the Asian background. So things have changed, you know, over the years.
What we haven't talked about, Lovemore, is your love for and incredible skill at boxing, and that weaves a thread through your life from, I think, what, you were 14 when you took it up?
Yes.
And were you 34 when you stopped?
No, I was almost 42 when I stopped.
42?
Yes.
That's extraordinary. And you went all the way. You actually achieved the zenith in a couple of different boxing associations, you know, title stakes. You became world champion more than once.
Yes.
And you can hear in the book how you write that there is something about boxing that will be forever within you. As someone who's never boxed, what is it like when your game plan or match plan is going well and you're in charge of your body and your mind and what's going on in the ring?
Look, it's a good feeling, you know, when you're in control of the fight. But, you know, it's always unpredictable. You just don't know what's going to happen. You know, you could study your opponent and plan, you know, a fight. But once the minute you step into the ring, everything will change. Your opponent might just bring a different game that you didn't expect. So you always have to be prepared for anything that comes. My boxing career wasn't smooth all the way.
No.
You know, I was sidelined on a number of occasions, you know, and I recall even after I came to Australia, you know, at some stage I was sitting number two WBC, so I was ranked number two in the world. But, you know, for almost 2 years, I was sitting there and nobody wanted to fight me. I wasn't getting an opportunity to fight for the title.
It's a dirty game, as you point out. The promoters, the managers, there's so many people on the take with a view to anything but compassion or scruples, although there are good people you found along the way.
Oh, yeah, there are some good people as well. You know, I chased my dream and eventually I won 3 world titles.
It's amazing. And I take it from the way you're discussing it, there's some great comparisons between that and representing your client in the ring of the court.
Look, there's a lot of similarities between law and boxing. You know, you got to have some confidence as a fighter. You know, some people might say you're cocky, but you got to have that. You can't step into the ring while you're not sure, you know, about yourself. That's when you get knocked out. Same thing when you step in a courtroom, you know, you got to have some confidence. You know, some people may say you're cocky, but that's fine. You know, you need to persuade, you know, the judge to rule in your favor.
You represent a whole range of clients, some with mental health issues, some perhaps with marital or relationship issues that need to be represented in court. But you also make a point of representing, sometimes for nothing, the cases where you represent Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander people.
Yes, look, for me, it's a way of giving back to the community. And I wish, you know, my learned friends, you know, could do the same. You know, we should give back to the community. We should always give back to the community. For me, it's a way of saying thank you to the Indigenous people. And you know what? I look at Indigenous people, I see a lot of, you know, similarities, you know. When I look at my lifestyle, you know, where I come from and, you know, their lifestyle, you know, they've been through a lot. I mean, even if we look at it today, you know, where we're talking about, you know, Black Lives Matter, you know, the truth is, you know, there's a lot of Indigenous people in custody, you know, as compared to any other, you know, any other nations. But the thing is, when we talk about Black Lives Matter, people often think, you know, we're saying Black Lives Matter and other lives don't matter. Now, that's not it. We're saying in the context, you know, of, you know, people dying in custody, Black Lives Matter. Because if you look at the statistics, you know, there are more Indigenous people or more Black people dying in custody, you know, than other, you know, than other races, you know. But that doesn't mean other lives don't matter. They do matter.
You could have been one of those people dying in custody at the age of 16.
Oh yeah, definitely. And I have friends who have died in custody. So I've seen this happen, you know, and it's continuing. These things shouldn't be happening. People shouldn't be dying in custody. So we need to do something about it.
Lovemore, it's been such a delight to talk to you today. Thank you so much indeed. Your book is called Tough Love. It's a story from childhood through to present day about a man struggling to have his voice heard, whether it be in the boxing ring through his fists or in the court or with his family or against injustice in general. And it's been a great delight. Thank you very much.
Thanks for having me on the program. Much appreciated.
Lovemore Ndol, who is my guest today and author of the book, Tough Love. This is Life Matters.